طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we take a look at the rapidly growing web of censorship being cast over our colleges and universities, libraries, and other major U.S. institutions that provide public forums. The Palestinian narrative and resistance is being silenced throughout the country by pressure from the Israeli lobby, which is spending literally millions of dollars to stop and prevent criticism of Israel. The conflation of anti-Semitism with criticism of Israel, the threatened withdrawal of financial support, the cancellation of pro-Palestinian events and organizing, are just some of the tools being used to silence the Palestinian resistance to the Israeli occupation, the theft of their land, and the slaughter of their people in besieged Gaza and the West Bank. The Nation magazine put together today's forum to sound the alarm of this staggering, organized, and well-financed program to censor Palestinian voices and events that dare to challenge occupation, apartheid, and colonization. The forum begins with framing and introductions by The Nation's publisher, Catherine Vandenhoevel.
Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are. When we posted this seminar, this Zoom webinar, we received approximately 1,000 responses in about 2 hours. That is a measure of the interest, the extraordinary interest in this panel. And we do have extraordinary panelists. Don Gutenplan, editor of The Nation, will introduce them. But I wanted to just say a word about how, you know, we live in a time of speech, and a time of boundaries, of land, of censorship. And the issue of speech and freedom of speech has long been aligned with The Nation, its history, its mission, its purpose. In 1953, we did a special issue on How Free is Free, which was all about speech. And we covered the hearings, which looked too eerily like the one we saw last week of the university presidents, and we may see more. But thank you for joining. We will publish an edited version of this conversation, taking advantage of our new monthly circulation, which will allow us to do many different formats and deep reads and other exciting stories and articles and deep dives. But I want to turn it over to Don, who joined The Nation many, many years ago as the UK co-correspondent. He's been editor of The Nation since 2019. He wrote an extraordinary book called The Holocaust on Trial. It was about the Penguin case. It was Lipstadt versus Irving. And Don was an editor of the Jewish Quarterly in London before coming to New York. And I want to say, having had Viet as part of our seminars, go back, if you would, after this great panel and look at his conversation with Art Spiegelman. This has been underway a long time at Matters of Speech and Boundaries. So thank you. And thank you for taking time to join us. And all of you on the Zoom, thank you for taking time to join us. And we look forward to your questions, which there will be many, I am sure, after Don moderates the conversation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Katrina. And welcome, everyone. I'm Don Guttenplan. As Katrina said, I've been the editor of The Nation since June 2019. And it is a great pleasure to be here. The title we advertised this as is, can we talk about Palestine? And the answer to that question at the Nation is absolutely yes. But we are wondering, and we are going to be discussing this evening why that is not true in other parts of the United States, and indeed in the world media. So I'm going to introduce our panelists, and then I'm going to ask a question, and then we'll get underway. So, Viet Thanh Nguyen's first novel, The Sympathizer, was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for fiction in 2016. He's also been the recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Award and Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship. His second novel, The Committed, which continues the story of the sympathizer, was published in 2021. His most recent book, A Man of Two Faces, described as, quote, a memoir, a history, a memorial, was published this fall. And presumably it was an appearance to promote or discuss that book at the 92nd Street Y, which was canceled in October because of his signing an open letter in the London Review of Books, which I note was also signed by Ben Moser, Leila Lalami, Gary Young, Dave Zirin, and 700 other people. But those four people are all on the nation's masthead. So I just thought that was worth noting. And Viet joins us from Los Angeles today. Radhika Senath is a senior staff attorney at Palestine Legal, where she oversees the organization's casework on free speech, censorship, and academic freedom. In a recent article for the Boston Review describing what others have called the Palestine exception to free speech, she wrote that since October 7th, quote, my office has received a tsunami of requests for legal help from people who've been fired, doxxed, canceled, censored, and physically threatened for speaking out for Palestinian freedom. No profession is untouched. We've received over 370 calls from lawyers, doctors, journalists, professors, teachers, students, and other workers in nonprofits, government, and the corporate world who've been fired, locked out of email accounts, questioned, or put on leave for signing open letters or for retweeting material criticizing Israel. Perhaps that will soon include university presidents. Anyway, Radhika, it's a pleasure to have you with us, and she joins us from New York City. From 2010 to 2020, Nathan Thrall was the director of the Arab-Israeli Project at the International Crisis Group and was based, at least for much of that time, in Gaza. His first book, the essay collection, The Only Language They Understand, Forcing Compromise in Israel and Palestine, was published in 2017. Last spring, he taught a course on Israel and apartheid at Bard College. His most recent book, A Day in the Life of Abd Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy, was published on October 3rd, 2023, by Metropolitan Books. He joins us tonight from Brooklyn, but planned to return to Jerusalem shortly. And most familiar to nation people, I would hope, is Muhammad Al-Kurd, a writer and poet from Sheikh Jarrah, Jerusalem, currently serving as the nation's first ever Palestine correspondent. In 2009, part of his family's home in Sheikh Jarrah was seized by Israeli settlers. His first poetry collection, Rivka, was published by Haymarket in 2021, and he has a forthcoming nonfiction project tentatively titled A Million States in One. And Mohammed, where are you joining us from this evening?
I'm actually in London right
Ah,
now.
all right. Well, it's great to have you with us. Thank you for joining us. So, as Katrina said, I'm going to begin by asking each of you to describe your own recent experiences with censorship, curtailed speech on this issue. And I'm going to start with Radhika because I think you can give us the broadest overview. And I'm going to, you weren't there when we discussed this, Mohammed, but I'm going to finish with you because I suspect you have the most dramatic stories to tell. So we're going to build to that, but we'll start with Radhika, please.
Sure. So, I think we need to go back to the McCarthy era to see the repression that we've seen at this scale at Palestine Legal. And just to update the number that you read from my article, I mean, to date, as of today, we've received over 1,000 reports of suppression since October 7th. And no profession goes untouched. I mean, everything from doctors to models to Target workers. We had even a Santa come talk to us and report employment consequences for speaking up for Palestinian rights. So at Palestine Legal, we have been truly inundated with requests for legal help since October 7th. This is not new, of course. Palestine Legal has been around for 11 years now. I've been here for 10 years. But the scale of the repression is like nothing we've seen before. And I think last week's hearings really made that clear, where you have, you know, at the highest levels of government, people being hauled in for questioning to basically, you know, commit to defending Israel as a Jewish state, which, you know, this has no place in a democracy, right? And so you have university leaders, you have employers, you have trustees, basically interrogating people, questioning people, firing people for taking a principled stance for Palestinian rights. So this is what we've been seeing at Palestine Legal. We are basically legal defense for the movement for Palestinian rights in the United States, but we also track incidents of suppression. And what we've been seeing, I mean, the reports, I mean, this is really just what people have been coming to us about, but it is truly just the tip of the iceberg. Other organizations like ADC, CARE, have also been seeing a record number of reports as well, of censorship, but also anti-Palestinian discrimination and Islamophobia.
Okay, thank you. I just want to ask one question before I move on to ask Nathan about his experiences. And that is, when people talk about a Palestine exception to free speech, what do they mean?
Yeah, you know, Palestine Legal coined that term along with the Center for Constitutional Rights in 2015. And it's interesting how it just really entered the lexicon now, where everyone just throws it out. Because what we're basically talking about is how if you speak out for Palestinian rights or criticize Israel, you are treated differently. You're censored, you're punished, you're questioned. And, you know, there's a lot of talk these days in the past few years, you know, about cancel culture. And, you know, terms like this, but then you really see that when people are speaking out against Israel's actions, against genocide, how free speech kind of goes out the window. And that's the moment that we're in right now.
Great, thanks. So Nathan, I assume on October 3rd, you were looking forward to a busy and perhaps celebratory book tour. What's happened?
So the book was published, as you say, on October 3rd, and, you know, a lot of friends had told me that they were looking to the book and the reception of the book as a kind of bellwether of how much public opinion has shifted in the United States. And I felt like I was getting some early indications of that before October 7th. And I was, you know, on tour with the title character of the book, Abed Salama. And he and I were here in New York when we first got the news. And it was obvious to me, to both of us, that this was going to be a disaster for our message and for the basic idea of the book of sympathetically portraying the lives of Palestinians living under Israeli rule. So, you know, I had events canceled right away after October 7th. I had a major event in London, the biggest one that Abed and I had planned with PALFEST and the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. That was at a major venue in London called Conway Hall, and the UK police shut that one down. And they cited public security. We had no way to question that. The night before, there was a festival, a performance of traditional Palestinian music at a church in London. That was also shut down. Basically, anything with Palestinian in the title was shut down. The UK Home Secretary at the time, since replaced, said that the police should consider arresting anyone waving a Palestinian flag. Now, the police didn't actually act on that recommendation, but that was the atmosphere in the UK when we were there. I have to say that all the events that did take place, and there were some that took place, and beforehand the organizers told us how fearful they were of going forward with it, but they didn't want to be another organization that was canceling. All those events went just fine, and we didn't have a single instance of heckling or any of the kind of disruption or scandal that the organizers feared. And then in the U.S., in something like four other cities, I had events canceled. Avid and I were going to speak at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights at their national conference. That entire event, that conference was shut down. People had bought tickets, flying to Houston for it. There was a group, a pro-Israel group, that was openly lobbying the Hilton Hotel that was hosting it to shut that event down, and they succeeded. I had ads that had been running from October 3rd, radio ads for the book. And then all of a sudden, after October 7th, there were listener complaints, which the caused the ads to be pulled. And I was not ever shown these complaints, told how many, who they came from. It was they were just pulled. And this is a totally kind of unrelated to October 7th, really, but I was also invited to speak at the University of Arkansas. And along with the invitation came a request to sign a pledge not to boycott Israel or the settlements, because that is mandated by Arkansas state law. Or, Radhika can speak more to this, but this law requires anybody contracting with the state of Arkansas to sign such a pledge. I refuse to do that. The faculty who invited me obviously dislike this law. Many of the students and faculty feel that they're the only ones who suffer from it. And, politicians like Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Senator Tom Cotton came out and said, how great it is that this law exists and that they prevented an anti-Semite from coming and speaking at the University of Arkansas. That's been the process for me personally. I mean, I also have witnessed these hearings, and I have to say that I've been dismayed not just by what transpired with the three college presidents, but also the coverage of it in the press. I've really lost count of how many articles in the New York Times have referred to the refusal to condemn or discipline calls for genocide, which is a regurgitation of a total mischaracterization of the actual speech utterances in question, from the river to the sea, or Intifada, or globalize the Intifada. None of those things are calls for genocide. And it's just being repeated over and over again, including in the Times today. So that's been my experience.
Yeah. Can you, for people who don't know the story, can you tell the story of what happened at the Unterberg Center?
Well, unlike Nathan, my work doesn't directly address Palestine until now. But there's a little bit of a pre-history to what happened in the 92nd Street Y, which was that my own work has been deeply critical of U.S. warfare in various contexts, and I was actually invited to speak at a festival called Palestine Rights at the University of Pennsylvania in September. And that was a deeply controversial festival for the UPenn campus. And I happened to be, I think, on one of the most controversial panels with Roger Waters and Gary Young. Roger Waters wasn't allowed to come, so he had to zoom in to our panel. And Gary Young was supposed to fly in from the UK. And I think he learned the day of his flight that his visa had been, I don't think it was canceled, but they did not allow him to come. So he zoomed as well. I was only panelist in person on this particular panel. And Palestine Rights Festival came back after the events of October 7th, and I think helped to contribute to the resignation of Liz McGill, the president of UPenn, because it was a major flashpoint for some of the donors. Anyway, so I signed a letter in October, along with 700 others, as you pointed out, Don, calling for ceasefire. a letter that I don't think was particularly radical in what it was asking for or in the rhetoric that it was using. But I signed that letter and it went public a couple of days before I was supposed to make an appearance at the 92nd Street Y in New York City. And the 92nd Street Y is a very prestigious institution for writers to come speak at, and it describes itself as a Jewish organization. So I was supposed to appear on a Friday, and on Friday afternoon, I learned that the event had been postponed, according to the 92nd Street Y, but postponed without consulting me and postponed without another date. So we interpreted that as cancellation. And in fact, Bernard Schwartz, who directs the Underbird series at the 92nd Street Y, was so upset by what he saw as a cancellation that he insisted that we do the event anyway at a different location. And so we moved it to a bookstore further away. And I think it's important to bring this out because, in fact, there was nothing that I was going to say at the event that was going to be addressing Palestine, but simply signing a letter in support of ceasefire was enough to get the event canceled. And I think that my story is actually relatively very minor compared to what happened to Nathan and to many, many others. We, as Retica pointed out, we've seen all kinds of people getting canceled for speaking out or for the books that they publish. So I think this what happened to me was only symptomatic of a much larger issue happening here, which is expressing any kind of sympathy or empathy for Palestinians, or even trying to write stories that empathize with Palestinian perspectives, has now been rendered almost completely forbidden in many circumstances, which is only, I think, further incentive for those of us who believe in literature and the arts and free speech to actually continue speaking out on behalf of ceasefire at the very, very least, the very minimum that we can be asking for, but certainly demanding more exposure for Palestinian perspectives and stories.
Don, I think you're muted.
Thank you. I was muted. Thank you. I was just going to say that before I turn to Muhammad, I'm going to read the first three paragraphs of the open letter because I think it's important for people to realize just where this line has been drawn and just how incredibly moderate the tone of this letter, which led to Beit's cancellation, was. It says, "We, the undersigned artists and writers based in the EU, the UK, and North America, are speaking out to demand an end to the violence and destruction in Palestine. The deliberate killing of civilians is always an atrocity. It is a violation of international law and an outrage against the sanctity of human life. Neither Israel, the occupying power, nor the armed groups of the people under occupation, the Palestinians, can ever be justified in targeting defenseless people. We can only express our grief and heartbreak for the victims of those most recent tragedies and for their families, both Palestinians and Israelis. Nothing can retrieve what has already been lost, but the unprecedented and indiscriminate violence that is still escalating against the 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza, with the financial and political support of Western powers, can and must be brought to an end. By cutting off vital electricity, food, and water supplies, by attempting to displace by force over 1 million Palestinians from their homes with no guarantee of return, and by carrying out continual airstrikes against civilians, including those who are attempting to evacuate, the State of Israel is committing grave crimes against humanity. Its allies, our own governments, are complicit in these crimes." So, we are not talking about an incendiary piece of rhetoric here. We're talking about what seems to me, at least, a minimal demand for humanitarian for humanity. Anyway, what we've heard so far seems relatively dramatic, but of course, having a book tour canceled or a speaking appearance rescheduled is nothing compared to being bombed. So, with that, I ask you, what's been your recent experience, Mohammed?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for saying that it does not compare because it almost feels silly to witness both the killing of my friends and loved ones in the Gaza Strip, or, you know, the harassment and the violence invoked against my family in occupied Jerusalem, and simultaneously see censorship and repression of my own speech. I want to be clear, though, that the kind of censorship, and I think it goes beyond censorship, but kind of repressing my speech has been going on way before October 7th. It started kind of with a smear campaign by the ADL, and it was baseless, but it was nonetheless replicated by right-wing news media outlets. And it wasn't just institutional silencing. I actually admire the kind of lengths that some people went to silence me. A lot of the times we would have false bomb threats at university campuses, and you would have the FBI come to the campus and search for bombs and explosives or install metal detectors to make sure the event does not go through. And it's not just in the United States. I've been disinvited from the Goethe Institute in Germany. But in recent months, it's been happening a lot more. Most recently, we had an event at NYU to discuss the NYU Tel Aviv branch, and it was canceled by the school. And we had to do it in the basement of a church. I was invited and banned from Columbia University, which I have spoken at many times before. I was disinvited. I was banned from my lecture. I was supposed to give a lecture called "Perfect Victims and the Politics of Appeal," which the Nation just published recently at the University of Vermont, and that was canceled as well. I'm sure there's a few other cancellations that have fallen through the cracks, and it's not without racist abuse. Like, these cancellations, in my experience, have not been without racist abuse, abuse that has gone unchecked. And there's a precarious equation here, because on the one hand, what I'm being censored or punished for is merely language, right? I'm not Lockheed Martin. I'm not Hillary Clinton. I'm not Henry Kissinger. I'm not involved in anything systemic. It's mere literature that is being punished and censored and so on. But then organizations like the ADL and pro-Israel organizations on campuses can then publish incredibly incendiary, racist, and false claims against me. And the university can then uphold freedom of speech. So this is the kind of exceptionalism that Radical was talking about in terms of Palestinian speakers. However, I fail to feel compelled to talk about these cancellations, especially in light of the genocide that is unfolding in the besieged Gaza Strip. But I think this is something that everybody should be concerned about, because the United States purports itself to be as a country of free speech, and we grew up hearing about the First Amendment and so on and so forth. And it's quite ridiculous that this is the ceiling. It is so low. It's calling for a ceasefire that is causing this kind of hysteric repression of people. And regardless of where people, I am of the belief that regardless of where people stand on the political spectrum, they should be allowed the right to express themselves freely. So it is deeply and profoundly concerning that what we are talking about, what people are rising up against, is mere slogans and chants, is mere essays, is mere letters. This is what we are being punished for, and it's not a minor detail.
No, well, I mean, first of all, I just want to second something that Mohammed said, which is, from the moment we hired him as our Palestine correspondent, there's been an organized, clumsy but organized campaign to get him fired. Mostly slanderous emails, many of them repeating each other. And I suppose maybe the fact that I was for a while editor of the Jewish Quarterly and I'm not a self-hating person makes it easier for me to ignore this campaign than another editor might. But it's, you know, it's constant. I just want to second as someone who's only gotten a small part of it in my inbox, but it is constant. And, you know, we appreciate you for not very much, but particularly for not giving up. I want to ask Radhika a question, and maybe the rest of you want to weigh in. which is, we read in the New York Times that the presidents of these three universities, when they were hauled up before this modern day McCarthyist committee, were advised by the same white shoe law firm, which clearly didn't give them useful advice. So if they'd been smarter and called you, what would you have told them they should have said?
I mean, we're not in the business of advising university presidents on how to suppress their speech supporting Palestinian rights. So I think, I mean, but you know, if they had asked me for my advice, I would have said, you know, you need to be honest about what is actually happening on college campuses. And I think part of the problem here with their testimony is that they were trying to have their cake and eat it too. They refused to criticize the underlying premise of the questioning. They never came out and said, no one is calling for genocide of Jews on campus. There is actually a genocide that's happening right now, and we should be talking about that genocide, and that is a genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. They refused to do that. Instead, they were up and down declaring their support for Israel. And they got themselves into this trap that was designed to do this, right? And so when they ultimately we're answering about questions about genocide, you know, what they should have said at that point was that, you know, of course, genocide, if people are calling for genocide on campus, that we will condemn that, we will look into it. But because no one was actually calling for the genocide of Jews, they weren't able to do that. And I think that that's the underlying problem here, is where university presidents are trying to pay lip service to free speech while at the same time, not piss off their donors and their trustees, right? And you really can't have it both ways. You can't have a university that where there's open debate and free speech and discussion and people that are critical of a nation state that has powerful lobby groups defending it. And also, yes, basically have an environment where there's free speech. So I think that's the problem that they were in. And I don't know what happened with their counsel and why, why they didn't advise them of that.
Anybody else want to add to that?
If I can just add a little bit, I think that it's what we're seeing is how censorship leads to self-censorship. Certain words are off the table. Certain words can't be said, like genocide or ethnic cleansing, in regards to what Israel is doing. And here's where I diverge a little bit from what Mohammed was saying, because I feel that it's totally the case that I feel what I'm doing as a writer is merely words too, given the kinds of violence and death that we're seeing in Palestine. On the other hand, it seems to me that these efforts at censorship, which have been so strong, indicate that the words actually do matter. If the words were merely words, then there would be no attempt to prevent us from saying certain kinds of things. And I think I've encountered many people who have said to me, or communicated to me how silenced they feel. That they feel afraid of speaking out. They feel afraid. Someone emailed me today and said, I'm afraid of liking your posts, presumably because this will be some kind of trail that could be traced to them. And so the silencing is so powerful, and it shows that the battle over the words is a corollary to the actual violence and the violent onslaughts that are taking place. So as mere as they are, I think there's still importance to us. For us writers, and for those of us who work with words in the written or verbal format, to continue speaking out, simply because this does constitute another struggle over what is allowed to be, not just what is allowed to be said, but what's allowed to be thought as well.
There is, I suppose, we at the Nation are committed and have always been committed to the view that language matters a lot. I mean, we're journalists and writers after all. But I think one of the things that's been challenging, certainly for me as an editor during this period, is the sense that this is an issue in which real lives are at stake. Feelings are very high. Feelings are actually very high on both sides. And there are people who have differing views on what the final outcome should be in Israel-Palestine, who write for the nation and who continue to write for the nation. And I guess, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to have this event tonight is to show that it is important to talk about Palestine and that we can talk about Palestine and we can do it without having to all agree on every point in advance. You know, this isn't a debate, this is a conversation. But we all, you know, everybody on this panel may have slightly different or even vastly different points of view. The point is we are here to make space, to hold space for talking about what's happening in Palestine and why it's become difficult to talk about that in the American press and in American public life. So, yeah, I think we're all committed to the view that language matters very much. I have a question for you, Mohammed, and I don't mean this to be unfair. It's a question about a line in your book, Rivka, that I thought maybe you could talk about a little bit. You say, people who give excuses for executions fear the rifle more than they fear the reasons. And I wondered if you could say a little bit about what you mean by that.
This is from a poem called 15-year-old girl, I think. 15-year-old girl killed for attempting to kill a soldier with a nail file or something. I can't remember the name of the poem, but I wrote this after coming home from school. I mean, I updated it. I think I have updated it since, but I wrote this first in high school after coming home from school and watching a girl near our neighborhood lying in a pool of her blood. Her name was Marah Bakir, and she was not killed, but she was shot by an Israeli soldier on the pretext that she had attempted to kill him, stab him with a nail file or a fruit knife. I can't remember what the headline was. This was about 2015. She was just actually released in a prisoner exchange, and there was a lot of debate about whether or not she did it. I believe the knife was planted, but that's beyond the point. The idea was, you know, we are so quick to condemn violence. I actually don't want to get into a conversation about condemnation, but I'm saying there's a lot of vocal condemnation of violence that is unorganized, uninstitutional, unsystemic. And yet violence that is committed by men and women in uniform, violence but that is committed on a policy level, violence that is executed. For example, what is happening in the West Bank is not ordinary, is not arbitrary as in Gaza, is not as arbitrary as people purport it to be. It's following the Dahiya doctrine, which was developed in the Tel Aviv University, which advises the Israeli military to use excessive force in order to repeal popular support for Palestinian factions. So the line I wrote is to say that I think a lot of the time we tend to jump and have reactionary responses to spontaneous, immediate violence instead of trying to address things at the root cause of all of this violence. The Israelis are very sophisticated people, but I don't think they're sophisticated enough to understand that violence begets violence. And if they don't want to suffer violence, if they don't want to have to deal with violence against their army or civilians, they must end the occupation. They must end the root cause of all of this violence. And this is true across contexts. It's not exceptional or especially true about Palestine and Israel. This is true across the world. When you violence begets violence, and we need to contend with this, and we cannot continue legitimizing one form of violence that is funded by our allies and by the United States, and that is done by men and women who hold official titles, and that is done, quote unquote, legally. Because when we look at the world and we look at the moral arc of the world, much of history's atrocities were perfectly legal. But it's much easier to condemn them in the past tense than it is to talk about them as they are happening.
Thank you. I've been trying to find some reason not to be incredibly depressed the last several weeks, and so I've been reading "Say Nothing" by Patrick Radden Keefe about what happened in Northern Ireland, because there was a history of violence over decades and. at least for the last, 15 years, 20 years, it has at least ceased. And so I wanted to ask you, Nathan, you told The Guardian something, and I wanted to ask you whether you think this, why you think this, and whether you want to elaborate on it. You said, "This war won't end with equality for Jews and Palestinians. There will continue to be a regime of forced control, whether Israel is present in Gaza or it manages to find proxies in the Palestinian Authority that can help it control Gaza, or it just decides to leave Hamas in place. Meanwhile, it has to flatten Gaza in order to satisfy its own public, to give them an answer to the question of how it can credibly claim this will never happen again." Well, I assume that you don't, I shouldn't assume, but it seems unlikely that flattening Gaza is going to keep this from happening again. So I wondered whether you had any sense of, what happens and how the people on this call might help, because the arc of the universe may bend towards justice, but it doesn't bend by itself. So with that.
Clearly, flattening Gaza has been the approach of the last decade plus, and that has not been an answer for the Israeli public of how this cannot continue. And so, what I was saying is that all of the options that are being put forward are actually just going to, as Mohammed was saying, continue to lead to more bloodshed. And obviously, not just the extreme violence that we see today, but the daily violence of occupation. I don't have any belief that flattening Gaza does provide that satisfactory answer to the Israeli public of how this won't recur. And I don't think the Israeli government has any plan in place to provide a satisfactory answer to that question. I just want to echo something related to the speech discussion earlier that Mohammed had said, which is that all of these efforts, and Radhika can speak to this probably best, are very old, these efforts to suppress speech that's sympathetic to Palestinians. And what I've witnessed since October 7th is really just a new tailwind for these same groups that have been trying to suppress Palestinian speech. But the tactics are very old. The use of the IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, the attempt to slander people particularly the right-wing press, all of those are old efforts. And I think what we're seeing since October 7th is that they are just gaining new steam.
You have been listening to a forum on the growing web of censorship growing throughout the United States in an attempt to silence Palestinian resistance. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and on kkrn.org, where you can stream us live every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. If you miss a broadcast or want to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to our archive on the internet. Search for truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on This Week in Palestine Archive. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will be with us next week and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.